Hello, and welcome to Psych Tech, the Psychology and Technology Podcast. I am one of your co-hosts. I am Kelly Dunlap, and I'm joined by the cool glass of water on a hot, sunny day, Josue Cardona.
Thank you for that, Kelly.
You're welcome. You got to have some fanfare, you know? You got to spice it up.
Yeah, and it is hot out there.
Actually, no. Not today. It has been the last couple days, but today, you know, it's raining and cool.
True.
So, although talking about the weather is absolutely fascinating, we do have a even more fascinating topic to chew on today. You know, every week we try to bring you a different topic that is interesting and has lots of different feels and ideas and you know, aspects to it. And today's subject, Josue presented and said we should totally do a psych tech on this. And I said, okay, let's do it. So, Josue, what are we talking about today?
We're talking about a research project that they did at Dartmouth College in New Hampshire, I believe, so where Dartmouth is at. And the idea is that your phone can predict your GPA by sensing all sorts of stuff. And I thought that was pretty cool. And I wanted to bring that up because I've been a student. You've been a student. Lots of people have been students.
I am a student. I am currently a student.
So imagine, I mean, it's a really cool idea that your phone could kind of help you achieve your GPA goals. That's kind of their theory, right? That they can take all this information together and kind of tell you, hey, if you want a, if you're shooting for a, not necessarily 4.0, but like a 3.8 GPA, you know, like these certain things that were that your phone is sensing indicate that you might be in the moving in the opposite direction of that. And here are some tips on things that you could do. I think that's their ultimate goal on what it could be. Mm. And so far, it's more predictive and kind of looking at correlations between different behaviors on a college campus. And it's very Dartmouth-centric at this point. But I thought it was pretty cool. What did you think?
I kind of went through like stages. My first thought was, I'm really glad that somebody is finally accepting that student life is stressful and worth studying. So I was excited by that. Then I got a little bit upset / depressed when I read through it and it was all tips for studying and here's behaviors that you can change to maximize your GPA. Whereas in my head, I'm thinking, well, why can't we make school less stressful? You know, why is it that the student has to become this superhuman stress coping machine for 4 years at least, and the campus or whatever gets to be this horrible stress-inducing thing? So that made me a little upset. And then I'm kind of slowly coming around to an acceptance phase where after I read through the actual journal articles that they shared, I have some hesitations and some suspicions and reservations. But overall, I think it's a good step in the right direction about campus health and student life.
I want to touch on your second point because I didn't think we'd talk about that, but I want to make sure I address it before I forget. I think that things like this and I think, aren't you wearing, did you get a fitness tracker recently?
I do, yes.
Okay. So I heard a doctor, I wish I remember his name right now, but he said that in the future when more and more people, or if more and more people wear activity trackers and things like that, that we're going to be able to have an amount of data to back up what you just said about school. Like, hey, guess what? School is stressful. And then we have millions of people in the workforce wearing these things. They'll be able to back up, you know, they'll be able to back up what they're saying when they say, work is stressful, and there are certain parts of the day that are more stressful, and Mondays suck, and now we have data that proves that, right? And different companies can look at the data from their employees and be like, oh, shit, like everybody has, like their heart rate is through the roof, they're really stressed out, or they don't get physical activity. Like we can have all this data to back up that claim, and I'm so glad you brought that up because, yeah, school is really, really stressful, work can be really stressful. And even though that isn't the point of their app, right, the, what they're calling the Student Life app, I don't think that's the point. But I think that's a great move in that direction because at some point somebody's going to be able to take that data and look at it the other way and say, hey, you know what? Like, school itself is very, very stressful. And look at all these things that can help with that, but can't we do anything to address kind of the cause in this case, which is the actual school environment or classes or different things that may be going on at that university?
And I don't want to come off as saying that school should be easy or that it shouldn't be challenging or that all of the stress should be removed from it, because some stress is good. There's the Yerkes-Dodson law, which it's a bell-shaped curve. And on your vertical axis is the amount of stress you experience. And on the horizontal axis is the amount of performance. Or you can flip those axes, it doesn't actually really matter. But the idea is that once you hit the middle, so where you're equal parts kind of stressed and equal parts performance, so like the height of performance on that Y, like the very top of the peak correlates to about mid-level stress. So I'm sure a graph would really help. But basically, it says that there is a peak where stress will get you to your best performance. But any more stress than that peak point results in a drop-off, and less stress means that you're also not doing your best. So, I mean, if you think about if there was a test coming up and there's absolutely no reason to study for it because there was no stress, you're not going to study and you might not do well on the test because you don't have stress as a motivator to get something done. Whereas if you have 30 tests and you're studying for them all, you're not going to remember anything because you're so stressed that your body can't actually cope. So I'm glad that they're addressing it. I know one of the things was they looked at stress, they looked at depression, and they looked at loneliness. And they looked at personality using the Big Five. So for those who might not be familiar, Big Five is kind of the gold standard of personality measures in psychology. It's openness, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, and neuroticism. So they're trying to look at students as whole people, which is something that I do appreciate. Because most universities just look at your testing scores, and I have lots of angry feels about standardized testing.
And the stuff that they measure either automatically on your phone or through self-report is bedtime, wake-up time, and sleep duration, the number of conversations and duration of each conversation per day, physical activity, where they were located and how long they stayed there, the number of people around a student throughout the day, outdoor and indoor mobility, stress level through the day, across the week and term, positive affect, eating habits, app usage, and in-situation comments on campus and national events. So anything that was kind of going on in the area. So they took some context from current events and things like that.
So the idea of using the smartphone as kind of a passive information gatherer, that's nothing new. I know we use it actually a lot of times in psychology, especially if the person is, say, pinged at some point to talk about how they feel. And it's just a push notification. You click a button, I feel, and you pick whichever one is most relevant. So it's nothing new, but I think this is definitely the most sophisticated use I've ever seen of it.
Yeah. I mean, I do have some questions about the accuracy of the data because it is on a cell phone. But that's just an issue with cell phone technology. Like, everybody's probably... Well, actually, I don't remember the actual technology that they use. Like, I don't know if everybody had the same exact phone or if they just let everybody, just download the app on whatever phone that they had. I don't know.
Yeah, and I think it's another thing to keep in mind is it was 48 students, I believe. Mm-hmm. There were two studies. Yep. One was 43, one was 48. And one of the first things that caught me as the suspicious scientist is it's Dartmouth. So one is an Ivy League school. So you're already getting like super achievers. Two, it's in New Hampshire, which is predominantly white. And I actually did look up the stats this morning. Over half the population of the student body of, was it half? Well, about 25% of the population of Dartmouth is Caucasian, but 50% of the participants in the study were Caucasian. And if I recall correctly, only two participants in the study were African American. So it was almost half white, half Asian, which I still blows my mind that that is a category, because Asia is a really big place with really different expectations. And so I was like 24 white, 24 Asian, and 2 black. So it even left out all of the, any of the Spanish or Hispanic populations. And so the population they sampled is not, the findings I don't think are necessarily applicable to widespread. I mean, I think they might be, and even to Dartmouth itself, it might not be accurate. Because again, if Dartmouth is only 25% white, but there's 50% white represented in their study, that's still not a very good representation. So, but to me, it's not so much what they found, it's how they went about finding it. And, you know, graphing these student experiences, we'll definitely link to it in the show notes, the graphs they have. One of the most powerful ones for me is when they look at overall health and in midterms, and there's this enormous dive from like 8 to 2, whether it's going to the gym or socializing or how they feel. There's this enormous fall during midterms, and then it spikes down again at finals. And I feel like that kind of graphic representation of what students go through and how it actually impacts not just their social lives, but their health, their psychological health, their emotional health, their everything health, their physical health. The gym almost goes to zero during that time. I feel like that's really important information to have and to share.
Yeah, and it's almost like when you look at that graph, after midterms, it's like 80% of the participants were defeated. Like, they didn't go back.
Yeah, it didn't bounce back.
Yeah, yeah.
And something else to keep in mind is it was a 10-week study. So apparently, I think Dartmouth uses trimesters, maybe? Because I know my semesters are 16 weeks.
Yeah.
So I would be really curious if after, so your midterms were like week 5, week 6, and health, happiness, everything is at an all-time low, and it doesn't rebound, I would love to see that played out in a traditional university setting that uses semesters. Because if you're burnt out by week 7, how the heck do you get to week 16? I don't know. I'm doing it right now. I have no clue how I do it.
Well, you burn out 1 week later, right? Because midterms are 1 week later. And then, man, I wonder, yeah, what the spike would be like. I don't know. Yeah, no, I mean, those graphs are really, really good. And like you said, that's the one that really, like, jumps out at you. Because, like, even mood is going down, but there's no spike like there is for physical activity. Mm-hmm. And even stress level goes up, right? And
yes.
Then peaks kind of at midterm and then stays pretty steady till the end.
Yes. Hmm. And I just, another limitation is they were all computer science students. And yeah. One thing that we do know from the literature is computer science, people who usually engage in computer science tend to be, I don't want to say less socially competent, because that's a gross stereotype, and I don't want to endorse that. But people who are attracted to the sciences tend to have very different personality and emotional profiles than people, say, attracted to the arts. So I would be really interested to see maybe what an art degree would look like, because I know a lot of times one of the people I'm a fellow with at AU, she went to art school. They didn't have grades. They didn't have midterms. They didn't have finals. Like, it was a totally different experience for her. And so I would be fascinated to see how a different discipline, maybe a non-science discipline or even a different science discipline, reacts to these kinds of life issues as well.
Yeah, and like behavioral sciences or biological sciences compared to computer science, like the work you're doing is very, very different. Your midterms are different. The projects you're doing are different. You know, you may not be sitting at a computer if you're in another field all the time. So it depends. Depends on, there's a lot of variables. Yeah. Man, we just pick apart research. We should just do that from now on, because I love it.
Well, I mean, it's important to keep that scientific perspective. Again, I think this is fantastic research. It's very well done. Again, I read the journal articles. In their limitations, they address every single thing that we're talking about right now, but the limited scope of it, but that this is the first of its kind. And I completely want to give mad props for that, because I absolutely agree.
Even when they talk about it, they're always like, this is Dartmouth-centric. Like, we're trying to represent, we're talking about just one location.
Yeah, you got to start someplace.
Yeah.
What the reason I come at it with the more critical eye is because this particular article is currently getting a lot of press and a lot of attention. And that makes me worry that non-scientific literate people, like, say, the media, who are prone to exaggerating or misrepresenting information, take it and run with it, and suddenly every student at every university is required to be low-jacked with a chip in the base of their neck that tells them, you know, oh, you're feeling stressed, you should go swim in the pool. And so, yeah, I just, again, putting it out there that it's a really interesting study, but it is very, very limited. Great foundation to build on, but it's not going to be a one-size-fits-all.
So for you, like, looking at the different things that they measure, was there anything that stood out to you or something that you – some of these are probably very obvious, but some of them – did anything surprise you? Did anything
– Well, one thing that I really actually there are two things that stood out. One is that students who over time decreased their evening conversations, that's how they put it. So basically the phone detected that they were engaging in fewer verbal conversations – during the evening, tended to have improved GPAs. And they subsumed that the reason they weren't talking was because they were studying. But there was, as far as I could tell, and I might have missed it, but as far as I could tell, there wasn't a I'm studying button. So the lack of conversation could have been anything. Maybe they were reading a book of anime. Maybe they were reading something for fun. Like there's not really a guarantee that they were studying. So that was interesting. And the other one that got me was students, they either attended class religiously or very infrequently, they had higher GPAs than students who attended class moderately. So you were either there all the time or you skipped a bunch of classes and you were fine. But if you maybe skipped 1 in 4, you weren't as successful. So that to me was really striking, that there really was an association between, at least not a clear association, between attending class, attending lecture, and actually doing better. But they address that in the limitations, and they mentioned that since they're computer science students, and I can speak to this after having a semester of coding, being in class isn't necessarily helpful because all you're doing is coding. So you can easily do that from home as well. And sometimes it's easier because there's no distractions and you can get into flow state and you're not cut off and you can just go at it. So that was their explanation for that.
Gotcha. So what about, I mean, some of them seem pretty obvious, like physical activity. We know the benefits of that. Bedtime, wake up time, sleep duration. Absolutely. Like, at least for me in the past few years, that's been like the biggest change in my life. I prioritize sleep. I used to be the type of person that just hated sleep. I was like, that's a waste of time. But I've come to appreciate it. So that's really, really important. That was pretty obvious.
Yeah, I mean, they had some very, very good measures that are standards of physical and psychological well-being. So exercise, going to the gym or exercising in some way, that was a tracker, which I totally agree with because there is buku research about how your physical health and your mental health go hand in hand. Exercise is a great mood booster. You know, there's lots of evidence. It's pretty much just kind of acknowledged that being physically healthy is helpful. And maybe that would be something for the next rendition of it. You were asking about if something that I missed something or did they miss something. I didn't see anything about nutrition.
You're right. It says eating habits, where and when they ate, but it doesn't say what they ate.
Yeah, and I can speak from experience. When it comes to midterms and I'm spending an obscene amount of time on campus, which does not have the greatest selection of healthy food, it starts to be cinnamon rolls and chips and really other bad stuff. And the reason that's an issue is because, again, what you put into your body obviously affects your body. Your body is nothing but a chemical machine. And so if you eat crap, you feel like crap. So maybe in the lead up to midterms, when people are getting stressed, they start stress eating or they start eating poorly. And that contributes to the crash they experience physically and psychologically. And then fixing your eating habits is really tough, as anybody who's ever tried to change their eating habits knows. And that would be another reason that maybe why the bounce back after midterms doesn't actually bounce back.
Yeah. Yeah. in the future iteration of the app, there could be like a big button, right? It's like, oh, what are you eating? You're like, oh, pizza. It's like, stop right now. Stop eating pizza.
I know one of the fitness apps I have, all I have to do is scan the barcode of whatever I'm eating. Mm-hmm. And it automatically records everything for me. That would be awesome, because then you wouldn't just have what it is. You'd have calorically and fat and protein and vitamins and everything just already broken down and into the database for examination.
Yeah.
But that does require more participant activity, mm-hmm. and the presence of mind to actually do it. But I think that would be an important piece to add, because there are tons of studies out there that show that eating unhealthy foods is paired with depression and anxiety. Anybody who's ever seen Super Size Me, the Morgan Spurlock film about McDonald's, knows that if you eat crap, you feel like crap, both physically and mentally. So that would be an interesting piece. But again, this is a pioneering study. It's really the first of its kind, as far as I'm aware. Any of the authors even said that this is the first time that they are aware of this being done. And I think we're going to see more like this. And I hope we do, because again, I feel like higher education has become this enormous cash cow, this enormous for-profit industry, and the product that's being produced is the students. And that's how it can definitely feel. That's how it felt in my grad program, and sometimes even my undergrad program. Like, you're just being churned through. Like, you're being fed from the pasture to the pen to the chute until they put you out of your misery by giving you your degree.
Of course, now one problem with this is that if that data is available to the school, for example, and your habits aren't on par with what they would call a high-performing student, what could they do with that? I mean, instead of helping you, could they just get rid of you instead? Well, or put you on probation or something like that?
And similarly, if they're seeing that you're depressed, for example, one of the tables in one of the slideshows showed that people actually increased in their depression across the board. So, for example, at the start of the study, because they did pre-post, which is awesome. So another kudos for them. They did pre-post on mental health features. But yeah, at the start, there was one person who was severely depressed. And then by the end, there was another person. So it went to two people who were severely depressed. My question, one, if you find out someone's severely depressed, why are they not being referred to treatment? Because they should be. And I hope that that happened at some point. But yeah, you can't discriminate against people based on their mental health. That's against the law.
But a couple of years ago,
I don't know.
But a couple of years ago, there was this, I believe it was in the UK, I believe. And then there were examples of it in the United States. I don't remember all the details. I'll have to look it up. And I don't know if you remember this, but where they found there was a school that had one student who committed suicide, and then they kind of did suicide. They were doing very loose suicide risk evaluations, and they kicked out at least one student because they were a suicide risk. And it seemed like the school did not want to deal with that. They didn't want to assume that responsibility. So they removed them from the school. And then there were examples of it in this article. I believe it was a New York Times article. That went pretty in-depth into this, and then that other schools were doing similar things. And you're right, you can't discriminate on that, but there was this weird way of doing it so that they could kind of sort of get away with it at first.
Well, suicide is an interesting and special issue, because if somebody is a danger to themselves or to another person, and again, that's a judgment call, they can be removed for, quote-unquote, their own safety or, quote-unquote, the safety of the campus. I mean, suicide is such a difficult thing, and most colleges have suicide prevention and suicide awareness and things like that. But most students know that if they talk about their mental health issues, there is the chance of being, what's the word? Not stereotyped or prejudiced.
Stigmatized.
Thank you. Stigmatized and having stuff taken against them for experience or sharing what they're experiencing.
And with in the future, right, with apps like this, you may not even have to say anything, because
you could just be flagged.
Yeah. Which is the same thing that happens with health insurance, right? The reason why a lot of people have to pay more for the health insurance than other people, because they've had something in the past and then you get flagged. So that is a risk. That's definitely...
Yeah, there's definitely a potential for abuse, but that is the same of every technology ever of all time. But it's important to have that awareness that that kind of thing, it happens, and it's going to make it easier to happen in the future. And again, that's why I feel like it's not so much what they found, but how they found it. That is really exciting and interesting to me. You know, for example, I would say trust a counseling center with that kind of psychological data. I would not trust the dean. And that's kind of what I wonder, who is getting this information? And when people are being assessed for, say, you know, suicidality and severe depression, who's evaluating that? And who's deciding what to do about it? Because that makes me a little bit uncomfortable. I know they use I saw the measure they use. It's a 9-question, a very well-known, repudiated, blah, blah, blah questionnaire. And it's 9 questions about depression. So, but shorter than the Beck. But I'm like, okay, you know, yes, anybody can, or almost anybody can administer and score that and interpret it. But who is doing that? And if these students are in that much, that depressed, then I kind of feel like there should be something, there should be something there to help them. And I don't know if that was part of the study or not.
Yeah. And it does bring up the idea that if you're working at the school's counseling center, if the policy is that you have to report that to the, you know, you have to report suicidality and stuff like that to your dean, like you said, or who are you reporting it to and who's making that ultimate decision?
And that's why the counseling center, the strict ethical code that psychologists and mental health professionals have. So the duty to inform is really, really strict. So I could come in and tell my therapist, hey, I'm having thoughts about killing myself. They, by law, are not allowed to tell anybody. Mm-hmm. I could say, I'm having thoughts about killing myself by overdosing, and they still cannot tell anybody. I'm having thoughts about killing myself and overdosing, and I have a bottle of pills in my dresser in my dorm. And it is at that point that they must then act and reach out to either the police or campus safety or somebody. But you need to have the intent, the plan, and the means before it reaches the threshold where you can violate confidentiality. This is a really happy, uplifting part of the podcast, isn't it?
let's switch it up a little because I'm getting.
I mean, it's we don't want to belittle it. Absolutely not. This is stuff that people deal with all the time on campuses. It is awful. And most people are not equipped to deal with it, either as a person experiencing those thoughts and feelings or a supportive friend or even a faculty member, which, again, is why I am strongly advocating for. Again, I don't know who was running this and how exactly they evaluated depression and whatnot in terms of what to do about it. But this is why you need people who are trained to talk about it there to talk about it.
Yeah. And it is like at one extreme, like, yeah, it's not all about your GPA. You know, you are talking about a person's overall well-being, and their mental health is a huge part of that.
Oh, it's crazy. If I don't know, this is also not the happiest thing. Your GPA doesn't matter. Like, unless you want to go to grad school,
absolutely.
Your GPA does not mean crap. I learned that the very hard way. I was so proud of myself. I was like magna cum laude or some crap like that, and I was all excited, and then I couldn't get a job. So I began to realize that, I mean, one, a BA in psychology, you can't do anything with anyway, and you have to go to grad school. So I was glad that my GPA was high to get me help getting into grad school. But you walk into any place of employment, no one's going to care about your GPA. And so this kind of gold standard that schools have, which goes back to this whole, you know, money-making organization that schools have become, higher education has become, you know, they need their stats to look better and lure in more students. And so, again, they're using their students as their currency to better themselves.
Yeah, again, and that's the first flag that came up for me was, you know, what if you start doing something like this in high school and then you use that as a metric to choose who you want to come into your school because, again, you want the highest performers because it makes your school look good.
Well, I think I'd rather have that than do standardized testing.
Yeah, I'm with you.
John Oliver on This Week Tonight has a fantastic roast of the standardized education, or rather standardized testing, and how it is basically a monopoly, and it is very few people getting very, very rich, you know, giving tests to children that determine their future when they're 4 or 5 years old. It's absurd. The metric is awful. It's absolutely awful.
Just like how IQ tests are a joke. Like, yeah. IQ tests, you can practice, right, for an IQ test and get really good at IQ tests, which will prove, like, your score just proves that you're really good at IQ tests.
I mean, I guess it depends on the IQ test. I mean, there's some like the Stanford-Binet. Yeah, I feel like that one is not the greatest. There's others that I've worked with in practice that are helpful, not in predicting success necessarily, but in evaluating how well you, say, can perceptually reason, or how well you can do with abstract thinking. Like, they look at these very narrow silos, and they can give you kind of a score that encompasses a general estimation of where you are on the intelligence spectrum. But again, it's not going to tell you whether somebody's going to succeed or not.
Yeah, yeah. It's more about what you do than that. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, and that applies after. After you graduate, it doesn't matter what you did there. It matters what you're doing now and what you do afterwards. And
I mean, think about it. Someone could have a really awesome SAT score. And they could max it out. I'm going to date myself and say 1600. And I know it's 2200 now, I think. But that's all they do. And they don't actually ever try. They don't go to class. They just kind of, they're just really, really smart. And they take the test well. As opposed to somebody who might not take the test well and get a lower score. But maybe they're involved in extracurricular activities. And maybe they're in clubs. And maybe they play sports. And they're a much more rounded person. To me, that's a greater indicator of how they're going to do. Because they're actually active and involved in life. Which to me is a better predictor of success than what one test will tell you about a person.
At least for me, I always received that advice, right? It was like, you need to have extracurricular activities. You need to be involved in this or that, because then, you know, that will make you look more attractive to universities, and that'll make you look more attractive to employers later on.
But that's
true.
Oh, see, I think it's bullshit.
Really?
I do. I honestly think it is absolutely bullshit, because I don't think schools aren't looking for a well-rounded person who's a good person who's going to make a difference in the world. Schools are looking for somebody who can get good grades that makes them look better, who has money to pay them, you know, whether through loans or through, you know, actual whatevers. And they're looking for someone that they can shove out the door. I mean, again, they don't, it's great when one of your alumnus becomes somebody famous, because that boosts your profile. But I don't think it has anything to do with that person being a good person or a well-rounded person. I'm very jaded, and I'm gonna own that right now, that as long as I've been in academia, at least, I mean, I don't want to come off as saying that teachers don't care, because there are some teachers that do care. There's some that don't. But in my experience, the vast majority of, say, administrators and the people who get to make those big decisions, they are looking at the numbers. They're not looking at the person.
Well, I don't have enough information to argue that point. But I will say that afterwards, once you graduate, it definitely matters what you're doing. Not so much, unless you're like in an Ivy League school, then you're pretty much set. But other than that, if you go anywhere else, GPA doesn't matter. And what you're doing afterwards is what really matters.
Yeah, experience. Experience yeah. is worth more in the work world than GPA by far.
Plus, I forget the percentage of, what is it, number of, like the percentage of people who end up working in a field different from their degree. It's a little surprising.
I would imagine that varies by degree. Like, I would say most people who graduate with a BA in psychology don't work in psychology because they can't. Whereas if yeah. you get a undergrad in, say, computer science or architecture, you're probably going to be in that field somewhere.
I don't know. You'd be surprised. There's a lot of stuff you can do, and it doesn't matter.
All right, biomedical engineer turned therapist. That's fine.
That's right. The one, okay, and go back to the app after that long side conversation, which was appreciated, though. Don't think I don't appreciate it, Kelly.
It's okay.
We're good.
It's okay. Just keep, you indulge my rants. I appreciate it.
I do like the fact that they were looking at the number of people around a student through the day. I thought that was really interesting. Now, if you measure the quality of the people around you during the day, I'm sure that that would be even more interesting. Like if you're surrounded by a lot of, you know, positive, cool people, or if you're surrounded by a bunch of assholes or negative people, I'm sure that would have a tremendous effect.
Yeah, if a crowd of bullies just follows you around.
Yeah,
I think
exactly.
It would be a different experience than like a crowd of cheerleaders.
Yes, yes, absolutely, absolutely. But that is an interesting thing to look at. Like, was this person alone all the time? And then for some people, I'm guessing that that would probably be beneficial, you know? It's like, leave me alone, I need to work, I need to do something. And for other people, it would be, you know, have the opposite effect. They would feel, you know, depressed if they were alone all day. So that's that gets really complicated.
Right. And I mean, the idea of student life is super complicated because humans are super complicated. You know, I think about my college experience and I played video games all the time. That's like a lot of what I did. Probably the most of what I did was play video games. But I didn't go out and quote unquote party. That's not something that I enjoy. It's not something I've ever enjoyed. So my geo tracker would tell me that, oh, well, Kelly spent a lot of time at home.
She never left her room.
She never left the apartment except for class. And, you know, so that's one thing. But that made me happy. If I was out at a bar with a bunch of frat people, I wouldn't enjoy that. So even though I was out and quote unquote socializing, that wouldn't make me feel good.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting because a lot of people make assumptions about that.
Yeah. That partying is part of, or it's like that's this quintessential piece of socialization in college life. And it's not. And don't get me wrong, there's a lot of people that like to go out and party, and that's cool for them. But the idea that, okay, well, you know, for some people, being alone is what makes them happy. For some people, sitting and playing video games with three other people from their dorm makes them happy. For some people, going out and getting shit-faced makes them happy. And it just, it's hard to figure out how something would suss that out. I would imagine they ran analysis with the Big Five, the personality inventory, because if somebody is showing up as highly introverted and they're staying in all the time, but then again, it's really hard to tell. Are they introverted because being alone makes them happy, or they prefer to be alone or in isolated, or are they introverted because they have social phobias about going outside and so they really want to go out and be extroverted, but they're too scared to do so and therefore they're sad by being alone.
Or just being alone allows you to study.
Your
study time is, you know, of higher quality than if you're surrounded by people and music and a whole bunch of other stuff. I would even argue that a LAN party is not great for your studying skills if you have to study for a test. So, you know.
I'm not going to comment on that. I'm going to plead the fifth.
It all boils down to, if you have enough time to study, are you studying, right? I mean,
Or are you overstudying?
Oh, that's a good point. That's a good point. Yeah, none of this is simple. None of this is simple.
The biggest takeaway for this particular study was students are stressed. You know, there seems to be this cultural perception that when you go to college, it's the best time of your life and it's fun and you party and students have it so easy. And it's not true. All of that is not true. I mean, not to mention that the years that you go to college are also the years where people are most likely to develop adult kinds of mental health symptoms, such as schizophrenia. Onset of schizophrenia is usually about 18 to 25. You know, depression tends to pop up around that time as well. And, you know, it is fun. I had a blast. I loved my college experience, but there's nothing about it that is this fun, fancy, free, spring break, girls gone wild kind of perception that I think is perpetuated.
You know, I don't see, like, work on here because maybe...
Oh, yeah, I didn't see that either.
Because maybe at Dartmouth, you know, not many people work and study at the same time.
Well,
but the reality is that a lot of people have to work while they study. So, you know, you leave class and then you go to work and then...
Or you have to skip class to go to work.
Yeah, I mean, that's like a huge reality for a lot of people.
Or if you want to think about those who are on scholarship, you could argue that there's a lot more stress on them to maintain their GPA. Because as much as we say your GPA doesn't matter if you're on scholarship, it does. Your GPA is your lifeline. And I can imagine if my college, if my degree was riding on how I do on this one test, that's a whole new level of stress and anxiety that's just being layered on top of the normal stress and anxiety.
Yeah, no pressure. No pressure.
No, no, this is just your life, you know, your future, your career. You know.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, a lot of people who are on student loans, same thing applies. You need to keep a certain GPA to keep your student loans. Otherwise, you don't. Yeah. Now, if your parents are paying for it all, then it doesn't matter. Or if you have a free ride, again, what does that depend on? You know.
Or on top of that, what if, what if you're a student athlete?
Yeah.
And you're trying to balance, because again, the student athletes are insane because
they travel, they train. Yeah.
And I know at American, it's one of the very few schools, I think the Patriot League in general does it, but it's one of the very few schools where if you don't have a 2.0 or better, which is a C average, you can't play. So there's very few schools that have that requirement. And so at AU, it's especially grueling because if you're there on a basketball scholarship, but your grades drop, then you can't play basketball, which is what's paying for you to be there. And there's a ton of stress. And let's not even forget the developmental stuff of what it's like to be an 18-year-old or a 17-year-old. It's not fun times. It's the time in your life when you're trying to assert your independence from your parents. You're trying to developmentally, quote unquote, leave the nest. Launching is the term for it. You're trying to establish your own pack, your own herd, your own pride of college people. You are free from your parents for probably the first time in your life, most likely. I mean, unless you're like maybe a community college and still at home with your parents, which, you know, is totally valid as well. And you're trying to find life partners. I mean, a lot of people, it's not the point of going to college, but a lot of people find a significant other through their college experience or experience their very first serious relationship or long-term relationship in college, or the death of a relationship, because if your sweetheart goes to one school and you go to another, you know, it's there's so much developmentally going on at that age. Again, it's easy to sit back as somebody whose prefrontal cortex is finished growing. Thank you very much. That's all I'm going to say about how old I am. And out of the college experience to look back and go, oh, well, it's fine. Just get over it. But when you're in it and when you are that young and your personality is still forming and your prefrontal cortex, of course, being where decisions are made, consequences, pro, cons, being able to schedule, plan, see consequences, things like that is still developing. It can feel like the world could be ending and your coping mechanisms aren't as developed. And there's just so much going on at that age.
So a lot of what we're talking about now is kind of out of your control. And I think the app does a really good job in focusing on things that you probably can't control for the most part. And that's kind of the point, right? How do you take different information, put it all together, create an awareness of it, create an awareness of the bigger picture, and then can you do anything with that information, you know, change your behavior to kind of achieve your goal, which would, in this case, in the study's case, is kind of reach a particular GPA. I like the idea that maybe I'm like, you know what, I don't need a 4.0, I'm good with a 3.0, what can I do? Well, that means you can do this much more video gaming and this much more partying, and you can sleep 1 hour less. I'm like, all right, so I have some, you know, some leeway there. You know, and there's different ways to do that, and the only way to really, really be able to do that is by taking that big picture look and looking at all this information. And again, there's lots of things that aren't taken into account here, but I'm really excited about it. I think it's a good conversation to have. And it's like, hey, guys, these three things that we talk about usually separately, let's put them together. Let's put them on a chart and let's see what effect it has. And if you modify one, what effect does it have on the other? And I like it. I want to see the next iteration of it. I want to see what other people are doing with this idea, because I'm sure that Dartmouth, you know, that this isn't the only version out there of people working on something like this.
And again, this is not to throw cold water on the study. It's actually praise for the study, because good research begets more research. I mean, the last piece of any research article is about future research. Like, here are ideas for what can happen next. And so that's another reason why I feel like this study is good, because it brings up all of these questions about what makes a student, and how do we categorize studying and students and the relationship that they have with the university and GPA and their physical and mental health. And so, yeah, I mean, obviously there's tons of things outside of the control, and every study it's only a study. It can only be so much. But I think this particular one will spark off many similar studies that will delve deeper and look at different data sets, maybe have hopefully a larger participant pool that's more diverse and more representative of college people, I guess, college age individuals or people going to maybe non-Ivy League schools. But yeah, you got to start somewhere. So I'm also very excited by this research. I'm excited at looking at students as human beings going through a very difficult time in their lives and doing this massive juggling act. And yeah, I mean, obviously we've generated a really great conversation about it with minimum tangents about standardized testing.
There were a lot of tangents, actually.
Well, it just says standardized testing tangents. Those can get nasty. But yeah, no, I'm also excited. Again, don't want to be cold water on the research, but just exploring, you know, this is out there now. So what's next? And that's what I'm always looking for, is what does the next iteration look like?
And as a counselor, it's really hard for me to get that big picture look at people's lives, right?
Oh,
like,
yeah.
You try to touch different things. So, and this is actually the type of thing that I like to do. I like to, even if it's something basic, like just like a Google form that I can create, you know, that's like a daily check-in, something you can do every day, that kind of thing. It helps kind of, again, for the student, the client, the patient, to build awareness. But it's also good if I'm working with someone and I have that big picture, I can definitely help you achieve particular goals if I have a lot of that information. So at least my practice has been moving in this direction for a while now, and I would like to think that that's the future of where we're going, you know, where we can use this information in the helping professions to really help people out, because we can see all these different variables.
We want to use the technology for good.
Yes, always. Just use technology. Let's start there.
All right. Yeah, one step at a time.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I think that is it for this episode of Psych Tech. If you need more Psych Tech in your life, you can find us on Twitter at Psych Tech Cast. You can also find us on our homepage, which is psychtechpodcast.com. We're on Facebook. We are on Stitcher and iTunes and RSS, so you can subscribe to us there as well. And yeah, let us know. We've been getting some awesome feedback from our listeners. One in particular, shout out to Megan, who is an old high school friend of mine, who gave me a very long, lengthy feeling or her reaction to our Zimbardo podcast. So thank you very much for that. And to everybody else who's written in, retweeted and whatnot, we really appreciate the love and support. And if there's something that you want us to talk about, let us know, because we're always looking to do more talking, because we like to talk.
We do. All right, bye, everybody.
We'll see you next week.